This is the Blaze Radio On Demand.
Every day on this show, we talk about the uncertain state of the world. Things are getting dangerous. Things are getting troubling. And when it comes to feeding your family in an emergency, you really don't want to stockpile the wrong food. You don't want to risk that your food will spoil and go bad when you need it most. That's why I like the Patriot Pantry brand of survival food. These meals are delicious, they are nutritious, and they are rated for 25 years of storage. I'd like to invite you to try some today for yourself for free. That's right, you can get four free servings of survival food good for 25 years when you go to freefoodone.com right now. All you have to do is cover the postage. That's freefoodone.com. This is a special offer just for my listeners, available only while supplies last. So I'm asking you, please, log on to freefoodone.com right now. Tell them where to send your free survival food. Again, that's freefoodone.com. Go check them out. Get your free survival food.
Now, spreading freedom across the nation, this is
3, 2, 1. The Buck Sexton Show.
Hey, Team Buck, so good of you to join. Thank you for being with me today in the Freedom Hut. We're at the final countdown. We're at the final countdown to an Iran deal. I don't think we're going to get a deal, but to be fair, it's not really a deal they're trying to get. It is a framework understanding, not a framework agreement, mind you. It is a framework understanding. They have punted on this three times already. They've said, we're going to have an agreement. We're going to have a deal. Remember, a deal is a binding, or at least theoretically binding, contractual obligation between two consenting parties. I will do this. You'll do that. There at least should be consequences for failure to uphold one side of the bargain or the other. A deal. A deal's a deal. Pretty straightforward stuff. That's not, though, what's currently being negotiated, or at least that's not the goal for the next few hours. It's already past time in Switzerland where these talks are happening, but there's some rumors and some leaks to reporters of how, well, they may extend this into tomorrow morning. Because one extra day is all that they really need to get this thing not signed, sealed, and delivered, but sort of thrown on the wall, messily discussed, and broad outlines, very, very broad outlines. You know, this is essentially like drawing in the sand and hoping that it stays there. There's no real outline. There's no real agreement. It's just an understanding of sorts. You know, Iran, you say tomato, we say tomato. You say highly enriched uranium, we say make love, not war. You know, we'll find a way. John Kerry, who decided to toss out an inshallah, which was on the Twitters and such yesterday, God willing in Arabic, about whether a deal would actually happen. I think he was just trolling his fellow Americans at that point, perhaps, trying to see what kind of a frenzy he could stir up. But John Kerry is confident there'll be something out of all of this. And before I give you my sense of what's going to happen and what's going to be the sort of longer term implications of this, let me just say that I actually really hope that I'm wrong about this. And that's an important thing to be aware of. I hope that my sense that this is a bad deal that will lead to not just bad nuclear consequences, but bad consequences of all kinds. Bad consequences for the security of the region, for Iran's willingness to engage not just allies across the Middle East who are Shia or who are useful in some capacity. Don't ever forget that Iran and Hamas, a Sunni Arab organization, for example, have very close ties, historical ties. But also around the world as well, that Iran might try to flex a muscle and be difficult. As you know, a country that has no honor or integrity to lose, a country that doesn't really care much about the suffering of its people through economic deprivation, is a country that can get away with a lot of stuff and can cause problems even for us, as was rather famously said by director, CIA director James Woolsey after the fall of the Berlin Wall. We were no longer facing a dragon, but we were facing endless snakes. Well, Iran is certainly a snake, and it's getting much bigger, and it will get much more deadly and dangerous, as well as more aggressive if it's able to achieve a nuclear weapon status. But I hope that I'm wrong about this, and I could be. I don't think I am, though. I think the Obama administration is really trying to prove out whether, to borrow from Churchill, to jaw-jaw is always better than to war-war. Always better to talk than to fight. But then again, keep in mind that one of Churchill's other famous quotes is, "We had a choice between war and dishonor. We chose dishonor, and we'll have the war anyway." I think there's a distinct possibility of something along those lines coming true, and coming true in a matter of years. But at that point, I suppose those who are negotiating this will be able to say that it was all in good faith. So what is the big problem? They were doing the best that they could. They were making a best effort to try to find some way to avoid strikes. You will notice that there hasn't been much talk about that. There had been reports previously about how the Israelis were imminent, about to strike. Never actually happened. And I have to point out as well that the American people, according to a Washington Post ABC News poll, are with the administration and yet also simultaneously against the administration, which I think is a pretty good description of what's really going on here. By a nearly 2-to-1 margin, Americans support the notion of striking a deal with Iran that restricts the nation's nuclear program in exchange for loosening sanctions. So you have that. They would rather have a deal than go to war, but nearly 6 in 10 Americans, but in the same poll, mind you, so whatever skewed sample they may be using or however they pose the questions, it is the same poll. They're saying that they are not confident that a deal will prevent Iran from developing nuclear weapons. So it seems the American people, by a majority at least, are saying, look, we'd rather have a deal than have to go to war. Or at least we'd rather have a deal than go to strikes, military strikes. But we also don't think that a deal is going to prevent Iran from going nuclear. This brings me back to what I think the Obama administration's calculation is on this. And it would be fun to sort of get into all the hyperbole now of, you know, well, this the policy is the constraining of America around the world and limiting of U.S. options and interests in the Middle East. I think that stuff's true, but I think more to the point on this with the Obama administration, they realize that they're sort of riding the waves of public opinion on this, at least to some degree. The Democrats firmly believe that a deal is the best option, even a bad deal. And even though there's a recognition that a bad deal isn't going to stop Iran from going nuclear, well, guess what? They still would rather have a deal. So in a sense, this is, I suppose, at least the voice of the Democrats, and perhaps even more broadly, the voice of the people it's being listened to, as much as for you and for me that may seem foolish and very dangerous. Remember, Obama still pays attention to polls, still pays attention to public opinion on matters of national security. That's why his policy has always been to do the minimum to satisfy the desire for action. I remember not long ago having a bit of an off-camera debate with a fellow pundit of the left, a rather smarmy fellow. And I had been saying that the Obama administration needs to take action in Syria. And he kept saying, well, what do you mean by take action? And I said, well, airstrikes would be a good start. And I said, you Republicans are always just thinking of something, always putting other people in some position where they have to do the fighting for you or whatever, some sort of a, you know, chicken hawk smear or whatever, you know. And in this particular case, I've certainly been to more war zones than this guy had. But nonetheless, that was the idea here, is that, well, what's the actual action going to be? What are they going to do? Well, 2 weeks after we had that conversation, the Obama administration actually started strikes in Syria. But it was the bare minimum. Precision strikes, just a few, 3 or 4 a day here and there, so that they could satisfy the public desire to do something about the absolute humanitarian and security catastrophe that is Syria. But not enough that they took any risks, not enough that they could be blamed if something went wrong. And that's really been the foreign policy. But there's also something more broad than that emerging. And the Iran deal is really just a part of it. And that is what I guess I could call the double back policy. Doubling back policy, maybe. You have the policy of back out of the Middle East and back the Shia. Back out of the Middle East in the sense that we no longer think, the Obama administration no longer thinks, that we should try to have a strong hand in the direction of these events because it's messy, it's difficult, it's a political liability, and we've had to fight wars there without the end state outcomes, although in Iraq we could start to point fingers as to how the outcome became what it is today, but nonetheless, we don't want to fight other people's wars, which is a sound principle. But there are ways to direct policy, there are ways to take action that don't require a full-out U.S. invasion or large ground troop presence. Those aren't ever really talked about, though. They try to force you into a binary option of huge military force or nothing. Just do nothing. Back us out, de facto back us out of the Middle East. And you can see this, and I think it's symbolized more clearly by this than anything else. You can see this with the abandonment of U.S. embassies in places like Tripoli and now Sana'a in Yemen. You see the abandonment of embassies. What better visual, what more clear example could you possibly have of the U.S. backing out of the Middle East? But then there's the back the Shia component of this. The backing and backing, or back and back. Backing the Shia means that even if we don't formally ally with them, even if we don't formally ally with them, even if we don't have some sort of agreement that we're going to be taking on enemies of theirs and thus helping them, that's what's occurring in at least some places on the map. And the most important places for Iran, people say, oh, we're against Iranian Houthi interests. Remember, Houthis are the proxies in Yemen. But people say, well, we're against their interests in Yemen. We're just really bystanders largely to that whole process right now. There's very bloody fighting going on in Aden. They've pushed all the way to the sea. The Houthi rebels are now fighting it out in the streets. We don't have a particularly strong hand in this one way or the other. We're not really doing a whole lot about this. But we are going after, for example, the Islamic State in and around Tikrit. And apparently today, it has been said that finally the Iraqi government, and by that we actually mean the Shia militias, have recaptured Tikrit from the Islamic State. That's according to Baghdad. They're saying Iraqi security forces have been in charge of this, but it's really Shia militias backed by Iran. Their main sponsor is the Iranian regime. So this is what's happening. We're essentially allowing Iran to fill vacuums, and the hope, I suppose, is that, well, if Iran fills the vacuum, at least we don't have to deal with the Islamic State. But in what way? And this is the question I would ask you, keeping in mind that maybe I'm wrong about the nukes. Maybe the fact that they've had to push the deal three times already, that even though there are six UN resolutions that say no uranium enrichment for the Iranian regime, now we're deciding, yeah, okay, we'll give you uranium enrichment. You can do that. In fact, you can park some of those centrifuges in an underground, very secure and hardened facility, and we'll actually legitimize much of your program so it can get larger and more advanced and more dispersed across your country, such that if you decide to cheat or you decide to break off the agreement, it'll be much harder to stop you. Maybe I'm wrong about all of that. Maybe. Though I doubt it. But I would say to you, on the notion of Iran as the regional hegemon, largely through a withdrawal of U.S. interests and alliances in the region, How is the Iranian regime morally superior to some of the jihadist Sunni extremist terrorist groups running around the region right now? The Iranian regime has engaged in the same sorts of acts of terror. It'll even do it against its own people. We are replacing one monster with another And the Obama administration thinks itself clever in the process. That I'm sure of.
Let your voice be heard.
Hello.
888-900-3393.
Bucks Action Show.
On the Blaze Radio Network.
Buck Sexton.
Oh, the Clintons. The gift that keeps on giving headaches and irritation to so many of us. So the Clintons, the latest here, and I just have to, I feel like I have to refer to them in the plural because you get one, you get the other. But you got Hillary now. More stuff going on with Hillary. There is an effort underway to have the Benghazi panel, the House panel, looking into Benghazi to formally request that she testify about her private email server while she was serving as Secretary of State. Now, just to review, to recap, my friends, Hillary was operating an email server in her house, and this was unprecedented for somebody who was in a cabinet-level position, and she took it upon herself to decide which emails would be private and which emails would be shared. And that's in addition to the layers of State Department bureaucracy using all the many carve-outs within FOIA for what doesn't get shared. And it's basically anything that could be construed as embarrassing, or they make FOIA worthless. Absolutely worthless. You should try this, by the way. And by try this, I'm saying this sarcastically. Try this if you're a lawyer when it comes to discovery, or try this if you're a doctor when it comes to sharing medical records, or try this if you work on a trading desk at a major financial institution or within an investment bank. Say, you know, I just decided to destroy records because, you know, I didn't think I needed to keep them. I'm the arbiter of this. I got this. I got this one. I'm under control with this. You'd be fired. You may lose your license, and in some cases you could even go to jail. That's just for a normal private sector person. And we could have a whole discussion over whether there's too much regulation, too many criminal statutes. There are too many criminal statutes, but there's too much of that stuff going on. But at least understand that as a private citizen, and for many of you who run your own business or work for a small business, the business records that you have, imagine you disposed of those. You're like, look, IRS, I mean, I'm giving you the stuff that I thought I needed to keep. Anyway, you see the point here. You know where I'm going. But Hillary's claim was that she somehow only wanted to use one device, right? This is what she said. You know,
I only wanted one. I was so hard. I have to fly everywhere private, and I have a staff of minions doing everything for me, but to have a BlackBerry in one hand and
I don't know why I'm making her 115 years old, but it seemed like a way to go. But this is what she's saying, that she only wanted one thing, one thing she'd have to have. And now we find out, by the way, it's been reported that she actually had two things. She used to take it on her iPad because, you know,
Hillary's hip, like, you know, hip to what the kids are up to these days on the iPad, yo.
Not so much. But she was using an iPad. So she is a multiple device user for her work emails, mind you. But the lie sufficed for the purposes of the Clinton machine when she said it, and now she's moving on. Also, by the way, we found out, and I was making jokes about this. What was once a joke that you could throw out there, like, guys, just wait until the server mysteriously breaks or all the emails are gone. I mean, am I right? It wasn't a joke. She did. She deleted emails on this server. Gone, gone, gone. And people say, oh, well, you could find them elsewhere. You would have to know where they went. You'd have to know what the transmission route would be, who else got them. And you're not going to be able to just subpoena random people's emails in the hopes that maybe there's some email from Hillary Clinton. That's not going to work. She deleted them. But just as we heard with the IRS, by the way, when they told us that they lost emails for Lois Lerner, could never find them. Oh. No, they could. And now the Clinton camp has said, well, those emails are deleted as well. And we find out that, of course, that's not really true. It would be time-intensive and intrusive and difficult, but very possible to retrieve emails that she claims have been permanently deleted. I'd say that for the rest of us, all these things would matter, but for a Clinton, it doesn't seem to matter much at all. For the rest of us breaking the rules, well, there's going to be consequences for that. But if you're a Clinton,
rules are for the little people. They don't apply.
So this is, I think, now just going to, they're going to try to get her to talk about this. And she's going to just stick to the script because there's really, as much as I know, everyone's going to say, oh, no, she's violated all these laws. I'm telling you, they're not going to get her on a legal issue here. They can only get her on the political issue of being shady, of being manipulative and overly Machiavellian, clearly trying to defeat transparency, being very Clintonian. That's the only way you can actually have this have some impact. If you think you're going to drag her in front of a grand jury for emails that she chose to delete on her own server, you're going to have to show me the statute and show me the prosecutor who's going to do it. Once again, Clintonianism, it seems, thrives.
Buck Sexton, The Blaze Radio Network.
Are you looking to save 50, 60, even 70% on your phone bill? Well, here's a tip. Broadvoice.com. Hi, it's Brad Staggs of Blaze TV here. Broadvoice offers high-quality phone service for only $8.95 a month. You may ask, how can I save so much money? What's the catch? Well, the secret is the technology. Broadvoice uses VoIP technology that takes analog audio signals from your phone, turns them into digital data, and then transfers them over the internet. This means crystal clear sound and cheaper phone bills. Broadvoice has been ranked in the Deloitte Technology Fast 500 and Inc. 500 as one of the fastest growing private companies in America. Get Broadvoice right now for only $8.95 a month. Keep your existing phone number for free, and Broadvoice will send you their easy plug-in adapter free. All this, and you get unlimited local calling for just $8.95 a month. Plus, for a limited time, Broadvoice will even give you your first month free. Do what we did here at Blaze Radio. Make the switch today at broadvoice.com or call 888-332-8036. 888-332-8036.
Get your Team Buck t-shirt at theblaze.com.
Team Buck, the Broad Voice lines are open, 888-900-3393. Also, please go to theblaze.com/shop. You can get gear there, Team Buck gear. You can get all the latest of the 1791 line, I believe, as well. So check it out. Let me know. And also, please go to facebook.com/BuckSexton. If you have not already, please like the page. It's a great way for everyone in the Freedom Hut to keep talking throughout the day, into the night, and 24/7. That's how we roll. Freedom Hut's always open for business, as you know. And I really appreciate, by the way, I'm seeing a lot of tweets and Facebook posts of people as they get their gear, whether it's the freebies we've been handing out on air here or stuff that you've been willing to purchase. And for that, I have to thank you. Keeps the lights on here in the Freedom Hut. But thank you very much for posting those photos and such. I see them. It's great. It's really sort of gives the whole team a high five. So let's, speaking of the team, we got a couple on the line now. Let's take Bart in South Carolina, the Polish pugilist.
Thanks, Buck. Hey, I've been reading recently American Betrayal by Diana West. I'm not sure if you're familiar with the book, but it's essentially a detailed account of Soviet infiltration of American politics and academia back in the 30s.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, these days you go on the news, any news site, and you see almost daily stories about Putin and about the possibility of escalation between Russia and the United States. You know, we've got paratroopers in the Ukraine, or we'll be going there soon. There's tanks in, I think, Latvia or Estonia. There's Americans in Poland. There's going to be some American planes in Bulgaria soon. So, and yet, none of this seems to be stopping Russia from essentially acting out its agenda, whatever it may be in the long run. And I'm just wondering if maybe the Russians don't know something about us, about our economy, that we don't. That maybe they have infiltrated us again like they did in the 30s, and they've got people in position here in the United States to create all kinds of unrest, cause economic mayhem, and so forth, and that, which is why they're not afraid of the United States. What do you think about that?
I think that
Well, for one thing, you know, there was this case very recently of Russians who were working in the banking industry. This was reported in the Wall Street Journal just back in January. Federal prosecutors arrested a Russian banker in New York on Monday. This is, again, back in January, and charged him as a spy, accusing him and two others of secretly gathering information about the New York Stock Exchange, U.S. energy resources, and sanctions against Moscow. So we have had prosecutors publicly accuse Russia of using spies, specifically economic spies. So, Bart, I just wanted to put that out there. So your theory about them collecting information on our economy and using that for national security and economic purposes is not some, this isn't pie in the sky. That's happening. They've done that, and that's according to U.S. federal prosecutors. So that's, so now it's the question, Bart, I think we can move to, is how extensive is that knowledge and how useful will it be to them in their effort to sort of counter us around the globe and also to see how weak we are here at home. I think you've got to assume that someone like Putin, who's a hard power guy, sees things in very clear terms from his own perspective, right? He sees Russia and, yeah, okay, oil is very, you know, oil is very low right now. And so there are, you know, the barrels of oil are not propping up the Russian economy because of the price per barrel as they once were, not to the same extent. He figures that's going to change. He figures that Russia has vast natural resource wealth, which is true, and people are going to need that for the foreseeable future, right? For at least the next 30, 40, 50 years, maybe longer. We're going to be very dependent on that. That's not totally changing. I know there's a shale oil revolution here at home, but things change, right? 10 years ago, we were running out of oil. Now we have too much oil. So I think he sees that, but he also sees, so he thinks Russia's in a good long-term strategic position. I think he also sees the U.S. at $18 trillion in debt and patting ourselves on the back, at least the Obama administration patting itself on the back for cutting down to we're going $600 billion in the hole for the year, something like that. Even if it's $500 billion, maybe, I think actually might be the most recent number. But whatever it is, it's way too high. We're already $18 trillion in the hole. And if you were to look back historically, yeah, we've cut the deficit substantially as a function of where it was within the last few years. But in our history, it's still like in the top five biggest deficits of all time. I mean, it's a huge deficit that we're still running. And eventually, you know, the music stops, we run out of chairs.
Well, what do you think, Buck, about the Russians actually having a hand in running the deficit up? And the reason I say that is in the 80s, the Russians had infiltrated socialist parties in Western Europe and were actually using them to further the socialist agenda, specifically to increase domestic spending and to decrease military spending.
I'll be honest with you, Bart. I don't think, I wouldn't put it past the Russians, but I also, I don't like to give too much credit. You know, as I'm fond of saying about the CIA when it comes to the way people talk about it around the world, if only we were as good as they pretend to think we are. And you always have to remember that it's a useful tool for a lot of dictators around the world to say, oh, you know, the CIA is omnipotent and they're the reason they're causing all these problems. And those of us who have been inside the agency, the intel community more broadly, will say, we wish we were that good. But they know we're not that good. They're just saying that, right? On to the Russian side of the equation. I don't want to give the Russians too much credit and too much influence in our economy. But I also think it's worse than that because it's not Russian penetration of government institutions or even U.S. culture, U.S. media. I mean, you know, RT exists. It's Kremlin funded. But this is Russia Today, for those of you listening. But it's kind of a joke. I mean, no one watches it. No one really takes it that seriously. So that I don't think has worked that well. But collectivism through the Democratic Party is a very real thing. And what was once the American Communist Party and American socialism has morphed via the progressive, via sort of a progressive mutation into real aspects of the modern Democratic Party, right? Collectivism exists in the Democratic Party. So we're running up these huge debts and having these problems because of, you know, we're doing this to ourselves, Bart, is what I'm trying to say. This country, Americans are doing this. I don't want to start pointing fingers because, you know, that's what sort of these tin pot dictators do. I think the Russians would love to help us along. I think that's part of why they're looking for economic espionage information. But I don't want to give them too much credit. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. However, I do want to say that, do you remember when the Iraq War first erupted in the second Iraq War, which was, 2001?
Yeah, of course.
And there was a huge...
Wait, the second Iraq War is 2003. Yeah.
2003, yeah. That huge, what do you call it? They called it a peace rally that happened in Washington, D.C., I believe, that September. You know, it was one of those that supposedly hundreds of thousands of people. Well, I just happened to be on the honeymoon in Washington, D.C. that particular weekend, unfortunately, and I saw, you know, these masses of people all over the place. And the people in the very front, the ones holding the huge banner that were leading these, you know, the masses, said Socialist Party of America. You know, this was back in 2003.
Oh, Bart, I saw it much more recently than that with Occupy Wall Street. Socialism is alive and well in this country, and it's not, I mean, it's within the Democratic Party, it's sort of cloaked in other verbiage, but I mean, the policies, our policies with many Democrats are completely, there's no distinction between them and socialist parties in Europe, but also there are outright communists that do exist in this country. They're open communists. That hasn't totally gone away. I saw it at Occupy Wall Street rallies.
Well, I think those guys, you know, back in during the Cold War, they were funded by Moscow in various ways, some open, some not so. So I'm wondering if maybe that never stopped. And all these movements like Occupy Wall Street and the Ferguson movement, any kind of anti-Republican, anti-Tea Party movements have some, you know, black market fund somewhere that is that Russians are putting, you know, their rubles in.
Yeah,
just a thought.
Well, it's a thought.
It was happening in the 30s here.
I'll take a look into it. But Bart, thank you very much. Always good to hear from you down in South Carolina. Cal, do we have time for Megan in Michigan now, or do we have to hold? How much time do we have before the break here? Let's take Megan in Michigan. Megan, we'll bring you in. Good to have you on the line. What's going on?
I just wanted to get back to Iran for a second about how they've supposedly have taken back Tikrit. The Shia militia, and with our help, with our air support, and it just absolutely makes me sick. We also, this was reported a while back towards the beginning of when we started airstrikes, that we flew air support for when they broke the siege over Amerli, and I just can't believe that we are working with the Shia militia in Iraq, of all places, the same people who are slaughtering Sunni civilians when they move in and take back a town from ISIS. I mean, this has been reported in the media over in Iraq and in the surrounding areas, and it's been reported on the Long War Journal. I mean, there's photos of mass graves. They go in and they burn the entire villages down. It's just
there's no question that there are some atrocities, Megan, that are occurring with these militias. And these militias, by the way, at a time when Iraq was, I want to tackle Megan's Shia militia question in a little. Megan, thank you for calling in. Let me go back to Shia militias and the nature of them and why they're so dangerous. But I'm going to have to go into a break here. We're going to talk about, for a moment, the new host of The Daily Show on the flip side here. 888-900-3393, taking a lot of calls.
Buck Sexton, we'll be right back.
The Blaze Radio Network. Buck Sexton, only on the Blaze Radio Network.
The Daily Show is very, very prominent left-wing propaganda. I've watched it many times myself, I have to admit, although I stopped in recent years. They actually interviewed me for a job once a long time ago, but don't tell anyone. I didn't watch the show then. I just happened to manage to convince their internship coordinator to give me an interview for a summer job. They did not pick me. I think it might have had something to do with me saying that I was director of recruitment for the College Republicans on my resume. I was still naive enough to actually tell people that when I was looking for jobs at the time. But The Daily Show is considered by many to be the most potent news source for millennials around. But Jon Stewart, who's been helming the ship there for quite some time, he's stepping down. Well, they're replacing Mr. Stewart, the much overrated as a comedian and as a political commentator, Mr. Stewart, with his 20-some-odd writers for a 30-minute daily show. It's a great gig if you can get it. I mean, that would be a lot of fun. 20 people working on your show, you just show up and go, hey, welcome to the daily show, you know, tap a pencil and go, oh, man, I'll do a few funny, things here, and I'll drop a few F-bombs just because that's so funny. And Daily Show, successful formula. That's how they did it. But they're being they're replacing Jon Stewart with a young comedian. He's even younger. He's younger than me. He's 31. A young comedian from South Africa, which is, again, one of those accents. On the accents that you shouldn't try to do because you're going to be terrible at them, Scottish is probably like in the third tier. I'd have to put Australian probably in the second tier. And South African has got to be like at the very top. It's really hard, you know? I remember Leonardo DiCaprio in that movie, I forget what it is now, Blood Diamond. He's like, you come here with your little bottles of hand sanitizer and your laptop computers. It's really funky accent. Sounds pretty cool sometimes. But anyway, he's South African, which is fine. You know, we bring international comedians into the U.S. That's great. It worked well for John Oliver. That's cool. The problem is that it's not funny. And in fact, there are more problems with that. But here's a little taste of Mr. Noah, Mr. Trevor Noah, at the Apollo.
Play. I grew up in South Africa. That's where I still live. I enjoy it. Grew up there during a time known as apartheid. For those who don't know, apartheid was a law in our country that made it illegal for black and white people to interact with one another. You know, this was against the law. And so this world was awkward for me growing up because I grew up in a mixed family. Well, with me being the mixed one in the family. My mother's a black woman, Xhosa woman, born in South Africa. That's one of the languages with the clicks, Xhosa. So a black woman. And then my father's Swiss. But they didn't care, you know. They were mavericks fighting the system. My mom was arrested for being with my dad. She would get fined. She would get thrown into prison for the weekend. But still, she'd come back and she's like, "Woo! I don't care. Woo! Come tell me who to love. I want a white man. Woo!" It's crazy, my mom. It's crazy.
All right, you get the idea. Look, he's telling a bit of his personal story here. That's fine, right? It's not particularly. It wasn't really funny, and there's maybe some other parts in there that I can't play the whole thing for you. But just to give you a sense of who this individual is, I thought I'd play some of that for you. But then there's a problem beyond that, the sort of the subjective, is he funny or not? Then you get into the tweets. Oh, the tweets. This is from Mr. Trevor Noah's timeline here. And I don't like, someone tweeted something, they have to be fired for a tweet. Anybody can make a mistake. Everybody makes a mistake. And especially if you're out there, if you're putting a lot out there all the time, you're going to do something stupid, you're going to do something offensive. And people, the totality of someone's work and the totality of someone's character should always be taken into account. You shouldn't just throw somebody overboard because of one mistake. The problem with Mr. Noah is there's a lot of these mistakes. This is from his timeline, collected by Slate.com. I'm trying to find ones that I can actually read to you without it being... Oh, yeah. Behind every successful rap billionaire is a double as rich Jewish man. Oh, yeah. The Weeknd. People are going to get drunk and think I'm sexy. That's what fat chicks everywhere are saying. So there's more and more. It's amazing to read through it. I don't want to give you more of it because... Oh, yeah. When flying over middle America, the turbulence is so bad, it's like all the ignorance is rising through the air. This guy's not funny, and he's a jerk. It's going to be interesting to see how The Daily Show tries to stay afloat with somebody who's not very talented and is accused by some of having some anti-Jewish tendencies. So we'll see if they can pull that off. I don't think so. It'd be great to have that propaganda outfit off the air. That is The Daily Show.
Buck Sexton.
On the Blaze Radio Network.
Spreading freedom across the nation. This is
The Buck Sexton Show.
Team Buck, thank you for staying with me into hour two. Very good of you to join. 888-900-3393 on the Broad Voice lines. We have Eric in Manhattan. We'll take a call from him right now. Eric, you're on The Buck Sexton Show.
Hi, Buck. Shields, hi. I wanted to call in behalf of the Indiana Religious Freedom Restoration Act. It should be covered by the First Amendment. It's the role of liberty of conscience. plays a pivotal role in American history and certainly should play a pivotal role in constitutional jurisprudence. And it bothers me that conscientious objection is not given its adequate due in even discussing this whole issue. It has nothing to do with in terms of discrimination, but the freedom of conscience that a person who is not trying to deny services or not trying to accommodate. It's not so much an issue of that as liberty of conscience, that you feel uncomfortable in a particular situation, a small business owner particularly. That's where I don't think that aspect of the debate has been focused on.
Yeah, look, I think that there's a recognition right now among many that, first of all, Indiana is saying, and Governor Pence came out, I actually saw some of the press conference he gave, and they say they're going to sort of adjust this law. The problem that's come up with all this is that there are 19 other states that have, remember, there's the RFRA at the federal level, right? Which means that if the federal government tries to force you to do something, you can raise as a defense the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. You can say you have a serious religious objection to it, and a closely held religious belief objects to it, and then the government would have to prove that it has a compelling interest and no other way to do what it's doing to override that. And that's for the feds, right? At the state level, this just means that that same principle applies to state governments. So the state of California, the state of Missouri, the state of Florida can't do. And by the way, I'm not sure those are, I'm just rattling those states off at random. I don't know if those are part of the 20. I know Connecticut is part of the 20.
Right.
But those states then also have to meet that test. The difference, as I understand it, with the Indiana law right now, as it was written and passed last week, is that it also is a defense against private suit by private individuals, right? Essentially, if somebody comes into my store and says that they want me to do X, Y, or Z, I can say, look, you know, I'm a Catholic. I don't want to go. I don't want to be involved. I don't want to be a photographer for your satanic mass. Now, the problem with that comes in when you are talking about particularly the LGBT community, right? Lesbian, bisexual, gay, transgender. That's what LGBT stands for. And I'm not being silly here. There's actually more letters in the acronym, but I can't remember them off the top of my head. Anyway, but Eric, so go ahead.
I'm sorry. I think it's LGBTQ or something. I think that's what it is.
LGBTQ. I think you're right. So I was missing one, but it's the same idea. It's sort of like BATFA. It's ATF. All right. You can add a B and an E, but it's the ATF. Mm-hmm. Anyway, but what I think is a distinction that is not getting enough attention is this notion that, oh, well, state protection from the state is one thing, but protection from an individual is a license to discriminate. That's what they're saying. But in reality, an individual who feels discriminated against is going to go to the state, and it's the state that will sanction you, fine you, maybe shut down or take your business because you have violated some discrimination statute. So the state's involved either way. I just think that this is, and I'm not, maybe legally speaking, this might not necessarily be the way that it the case law has gone, but I don't really care. I know what happens here. The state's what's called in to adjudicate the dispute, and the state's the one that actually uses force to sanction people for violating, you know, for example, the individual who doesn't want to be a photographer at a gay wedding, right? The state comes in and says, we're going to fine you or whatever the case may be. So this is where the discussion is now, and whether we can even talk about you know, freedom anymore in the context of religious belief. What they're saying essentially is that you don't have a right. You have a right to be in a church that says that it will only marry heterosexual couples, but you don't have any right whatsoever outside that church to try to live those beliefs, right? That's where this is. That's the conflict. That's what this has come to now. And I think that Indiana was unfairly beat up on, I think, for this, and there are many other senators, for example, in the past, Democrat senators, who have signed or pushed for RFRA bills. People are starting to see what the dispute is. The dispute is essentially going to force, you're going to get to a point where church institutions, you know, a Catholic church is going to have to offer itself up
for a gay wedding, for example. I mean, they're going to be, that's where this is all heading. I mean, make no mistake about it. And Eric, I'm sort of going on at length here, but I wanted to bring you back in. What do you think about all this?
I think that if there's any excellent points that you're raising.
Well, thank you, sir. Well, thank you. You're an astute man. Thank you. But anyway, go ahead.
I think there should be a standard of strict scrutiny in terms of compelling any individual to go against his or her dictates, religious tenets, or deeply held beliefs. And I think that's something that would be lost in this debate. If someone has a conscientious objection, they should not be compelled against their tenets to go against them in order to comply with anti-discrimination statutes. Obviously, there should be some exemptions, some provisions that would exempt a person in exercising their conscientious objection.
Right. I think, you know, I wonder how this is going to play out because it is getting so much national attention. And Eric, thank you. Thank you for calling in.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. You know, I wonder what the next steps are here. I mean, there was a point in time I can remember when it was just they wanted state, you know, government and state recognition of gay marriage as the exact equivalent. And then you do get into, I mean, a man and a woman is not the same as a man and a man is not the same as a woman. If you want to have the state treat them the same way or have the same legal rights, that's another issue. But, you know, this is sort of like saying, you know, two cats versus a cat and a dog versus two dogs. I mean, those are not the same things. So that sort of there's sort of a militant approach to this is to suggest that you can't even discuss a distinction, never mind whether there's a distinction as treated by the law, right? The law can treat them the same way. That doesn't necessarily mean that we all have to pretend that it's exactly the same, that we can't have debates over social policy, over whether what's best for children in the aggregate, those sorts of discussions. If you have to treat it all as the same and speak of it as it's all the same, then there's no more debate or discussion. Then you have a sort of absolutism of a sort of radical marriage equality in which you have to pretend that there is no gender anymore in marriage. I mean, that's what we're sort of going towards. That's, I believe, the end state goal for some of the activists, that you can't even make these, that the whole notion of husband and wife, no, it's just partner. Everyone's going to be partner. And this makes me uncomfortable. And that sort of dictatorial attitude is going to increasingly run afoul of people who, like myself, are very, very open to and quite honestly supportive of homosexuals in the sphere of government recognition of their unions. But there's a difference between government recognition of a union and, okay, so I want to get married in this church because I like it. You guys better do it or else I'm going to sue you. How far away do you think that really is? Look at the progression over time. Look at the progression over time and tell me which direction you think it's going in. I was going to go into a break, but I see we've put out the Paul signal. Paul has seen it. He's now on the line. Paul from California, what do you got?
Hey, Buckman, how much time do I have, sir?
You got a solid minute and a half, so go for it.
All right. Well, I think I'm going to talk about the most important thing first with the plane crash. Something that they're not talking about, and it's because there's so many pharmaceutical companies have a lot of power, and they're advertising all the networks and all the radio stations. The very fact that they would allow any pilot to fly with these antidepressants, let's say, just take Xanax, for instance. Xanax, they allow all the pilots to fly with antidepressants. There's absolutely no rules against that. And this guy apparently had a bunch of different antidepressants. And I'm just going to read just the Xanax label. Tell your doctor right away if any of these unlikely but serious side effects occur. Mood changes such as hallucinations, thoughts of suicide, slurred speech, difficulty talking, lots of coordination, trouble walking, memory problems. I spent time with drug addicted people, and some of the worst addictions are these antidepressants. And what happens is they literally rewire your brain. And the fact that they would keep – what happened was there's HIPAA laws, and Germany has very strict laws that keep that, – that because of the AIDS thing, they wanted to keep all these medical records sealed. Well, and quiet. Well, but the problem is that you have critical stations like pilots that they have to be able to be more transparent. So here's something that's a real problem. You know, like they also should have bathrooms in the front cockpit, like they do have international flights. If they really wanted to stop this problem, make people safe, then they would do certain things to do that. But it's not politically correct, and until it becomes until there's more loss of life, unfortunately, they're not going to make these changes in the flight. So,
well, Paul, I think that there's a few places here where we may have some disagreement. I mean, the prevalence of what you're talking about, for example, antidepressants such as SSRIs, selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, and other the drugs for anxiety, for example, you mentioned Xanax. I mean, the prevalence of those in society is something that is astonishing when you look at the numbers. And in many cases, I mean, they're treating real medical conditions, and people who are on those things are running incredibly successful hedge funds. They are they are driving trains. They are doing all sorts of things. You know, I could just sit here and literally people in every profession, many people coming back from military service to help them readjust and to deal with some of the symptoms of PTSD. Okay, but you seem to be suggesting that if someone takes Xanax, they can't drive.
What I'm suggesting is that there's a small percentage of the public that has adverse reactions. Okay, that if you talk to anybody that's had antidepressants, they will tell you that they went all over the place in their mood, that they went through suicidal thoughts, that, you know, not, in other words, you know, there's side effects from these things, and so that's all I'm saying. I'm not saying that they don't do any good. They're all bad.
No, of course there are side effects, but
right,
there are side effects to antibiotics too.
Right, but you don't let pilots with dangerous drugs fly airplanes that may cause hallucinations. You got to remember, one of the side effects is hallucinations. I watch a guy flip out hallucinations for 3 days on Xanax. So these are very real things that they're keeping a secret for a very real reason.
Paul, every time you call it, I feel a little bit like Ethan Hawke in the beginning of Training Day. I'm just like, oh man, this is going to be crazy. You got all these stories, you know. I was a guy who was on PCP, punched through 6 windows. He jumped over a building. He threw 5 cops across the street. I'm like, whoa, Paul, I don't know what kind of stuff you've been into. But no, look, thank you for calling in, buddy. I hear you. Thank you for calling in. In this case, it seems they missed some warning signs. There's a difference between somebody taking some antidepressants or taking, people have nasty breakups and they go on antidepressants. People lose a family member and they go on antidepressants. I mean, to stigmatize people that are seeking medical assistance for a medical condition, and Paul's saying he's not doing that, and I appreciate and respect that, and Paul's a good guy. But I'm just saying we have to be careful about that, because you'd much rather have people that have an issue like this get ahead of it, seek help, seek treatment, whether it's for PTSD, whether it's for anxiety or depression or any of these things, and manage it. Because the vast majority of the people who do that are very productive, happy citizens who lead respectful and productive lives. The problem in this case, from what I can see with this pilot, I didn't know we were going to talk about the pilot today, but Paul brought it up. The problem in this case is that there were signs of suicidal thoughts and tendencies with the pilot, as has been reported. That's another level, because, for example, and these are, you know, they require, for those of us who are in war zones, they require when you come back within the various government agencies that you sort of sit and check in and talk. And it's one of these times you're sitting in your life, wow, someone's just paid to sort of sit and hear my problems and talk. But one of the things I'll tell you is that, you know, if they will break the seal of confidentiality if you're going to hurt, if you they believe you're an imminent threat to yourself or to others. So that's always right. I mean, that's mental health treatment 101, right? Everything, there's a sanctity and a sacred nature of the confidentiality of those discussions, unless you're saying I'm going to hurt myself or other people. And then that overrides that. And it seems like this pilot, from what I've read, was basically saying, you know, I'm not sure I want to live anymore or something along those lines. You can't have a pilot who's saying that stuff. You got to address that. And it seems like that slipped through the cracks here, and that may be why this horrible tragedy happened. All right, I want to talk Shia militias. We'll do that when we come back, but also Broad Voice is open, 888-900-3393. I'll be right back.
Buck Sexton, the Blaze Radio Network.
What team are you on? Get your Team Buck shirt now at TheBlaze.com.
Broad Voice is open, 888-900-3393. Let's take a call from Danielle in Dallas. The D,
hey,
Buck, down in the D.
You?
Good. How are you doing, Danielle?
I'm breathing. I felt bad that I couldn't call in yesterday when you pinged me, so I thought I would, you know, try again today.
Sounds good to me. What's on your mind, Danielle? What do you want to talk about?
Oh, I was back on the Indiana gay rights kerfuffle. I think it's, you know, really, really stupid. And as a lesbian, I wish I had time to go to Indiana and eat whatever good food they have up there that's probably beef or something that would be tasty. I think it's really ridiculous to see this kind of thing. The whole argument's stupid in my view.
Tell me more about why. I mean, when you talk to others about this, I assume they're all very surprised. As you said, you're a lesbian, and you're expected to take a certain position on this, I assume, right, Danielle? I'm sure everyone that if you ever talk to anyone about this, they by and large, I would assume, especially if they're from the left, would say, of course you should be along with the activists and such.
Right.
I mean, what do you say to them?
Well, yes and no. I live in Texas, so not as much as you might think.
Oh, okay. Yeah, you're not in the communist paradise of Manhattan like me. Apologies, but continue
no,
on.
Well, I mean, there's two kinds of people. I mean, there's obviously the militant progressive people that want to force their way of doing things down your throat. Those are going to exist on both sides of this argument. I've had really great success, you know, talking with gay couples and with people that are like fundamentalist Christians that don't, you know, it's not their thing. And, you know, the whole thing with the way this country's founded, we can all exist and get along. I promote strongly the idea of civil unions for everybody. So instead of going to get a blood test and your marriage license, you go down and get your civil union and your blood test, and then you can go off to the church, get married wherever you like, assuming that church is willing to do so. If they're not willing to do so, then, you know, go down to the next church or whatever. You don't have to mix.
If I wanted to get, I've had a couple of friends, for example, who have converted because they wanted to get married and they talked about it and they've converted to Judaism. And that was a very involved process and it's taken very seriously. You know, if I showed up at a temple and I said, I really want to be married. You know, I really want to be married here. They would say to me, but you're not Jewish. And I'd say, yeah, you're right. I shouldn't try to, you know, I think that there should be some respect for that. And it seems to me that at least the activists within the gay community just completely discount that. They assume that it's born of some kind of discriminatory hatred and they won't stand for it. Is that your sense of it too?
Let's be honest. There's a lot of militant gay people out there and they are about, you know, sticking other folks in the eye. They want to make their point. They want to make you conform to their viewpoint. Those exist in the Christian community and in the gay right community. There are people that are just out to cause problems and force you into compliance.
I hear you. Danielle, thank you. I know I asked you to call in. Thank you so much. Always good to hear from you. Thank you for being such a good part of Team Buck all these years. We'll be back in a minute.
You're listening to Buck Sexton, only on the Blaze Radio Network. Buck Sexton Show, 888-900-3393.
I don't want to forget this because I try to keep my word when I say I'll get to something later. If I ever don't do that, it's just because I forget because we got so much going on in the hut. But Megan from Michigan mentioned before the Shia militias and that situation, and I believe we might have My friend Michael Weiss calling in tomorrow to really we're going to go deep on Shia militias and everything going on in Iraq, but just for now, as a sort of a means of prefacing and giving some context to all this, understand that there was a time when these same Shia militias, including the most among the most well known, were under the direction of Muqtada al-Sadr, who was described to me by various military personnel at different times as an evil little turd and sort of things along those lines. Not a good guy, someone that probably should have been at least taken off the battlefield through capture, if nothing else. But he was able to use this army, the Jaish al-Mahdi, which is a paramilitary militia. That actually wreaked havoc all across parts of Iraq where there's sort of a Sunni-Shia divide. And they engaged in atrocities. I mean, they were pulling people off of buses, for example, and asking them whether they were Sunni or Shia and executing them on the spot. They were using power tools and chainsaws, and it was horrific. And the U.S. military was in a position where they had to actually stabilize that country with al-Qaeda in Iraq and various Sunni militant groups on the one hand and the Jaish al-Mahdi and these other Shia groups on the other. So we were in the middle of what was a sectarian civil war, and our troops were able to defuse and defeat that civil war for the time. Now, of course, as we know, we pulled out and now it's all jumped up and come back up again. But the Mahdi army, or the Jaish al-Mahdi, is a group that has lots of blood on its hands. And also keep in mind that the Iranian policy at the time, this is the government that President Obama's bending over backwards to come to some sort of an agreement with. Remember, it's not a bad agreement or war. The choice could be a bad agreement or really strict sanctions and pressing for regime change. That's also on the table as a possibility. But nonetheless, the policy of Iran at the time was, well, Iraq is in the throes of chaos and misery and widespread bloodletting. The policy of Iran was, let's just add to that. Let's just make it even worse. And let's go after U.S. troops who are trying to provide basic security for people. I mean, people forget this. They talk about the U.S. occupation. And I mean, I know this and I saw this myself. You have U.S. troops who are out there setting up schools, who are turning on water, who are turning on electricity, who are providing security so that Iraqi Sunnis or Iraqi Shia weren't going to see their entire family executed in front of their eyes before perhaps they themselves were executed and or raped. That's what our troops were over there doing. And as they were fighting that very difficult battle and taking high value targets off the battlefield and providing population security, waging the very difficult counterinsurgency struggle. As I've said before, the famous phrase is counterinsurgency is like eating soup with a knife, slow, messy, and difficult. And it's absolutely true. But they were doing all of that, and the Iranians thought, well, let's use these Shia militias and let's use the sort of specialized Shia groups to attack U.S. troops. Because the more chaos, the more bloodshed, the better. And they were deploying these EFPs, these explosively formed penetrators, specifically designed to breach the armored hull of U.S. military vehicles. And even in cases where they weren't lethal for our troops, many limbs were lost, many severe injuries were sustained because of those devices. That was Iranian government policy. And so for those who served and still serve, those wounds, literally and figuratively, are fresh. It was not long ago. And so now we're trying to reach some sort of agreement with this country, not taking into account that we are dealing with monsters. All right, let me take some calls here. We have John in Long Island. John, you are on the Buck Sexton Show.
Hi, Buck. Did I miss the boat on RFRA?
No, sir. Not at all. We're wide open here. What's up with the RFRA in your mind?
All right, I have a point to make. I promise I'll circle back to how it relates to RFRA, but I just turned 24, and every morning I listen to the most popular sports talk show in New York, and I'm not sure if you're familiar with what it is. Regardless, it amazes me, it astounds me how people are so uninformed. They'll call into these sports talk shows. They've done so much detailed research to come to the table with sports statistics going back 40 years. But if you were to ask any of these people who Valerie Jarrett is, they'd look at you like you had four heads. And the reason I say it is a point I've been wanting to make for a long time. It just drives me nuts. And, you know, as a millennial, I see it with so many of my friends, just how out of touch they are with what's going on. And I listen to that stuff because I know that I do my due diligence by listening to you every day, by listening to Mark Levin, by being well-read on what's going on. And it drives me crazy. But the point about RFRA is, so today they're going off on Indiana and the state of Indiana and how they should be boycotting it with the national championship and all these things. All the sports should pull out and they should never have Super Bowls anymore. And this is why we can't win the argument, because we can't ever get our voice in there to say, you know, these people are praising the hosts of these shows, and these guys are irresponsibly getting on there and blabbering. It's not true the things they're saying, you know. Oh, it just openly allows for the discrimination of people based on their sexual preference. Yeah, it made it legal for you to be, anti-gay and refuse service to gay people just because you want to. And we can't even get our voice in there to say that's just not true. And these people are reaching out to millions of people who don't pay attention at all, and they believe it, and they eat it up.
Yeah, you know, John, especially, I see this with a lot of sort of more entertainment media talk, not necessarily talking heads, entertainment media people. They will figure out what the most popular position is on a political issue and just sort of give the most rote, basic talking points on that. And the problem is that the feedback mechanisms for them are that the dominant media organizations, the mainstream media organizations, are going to loud them for it. They're going to say, oh, that's great. You know, look at so-and-so. He's, you know, he's a sportscaster, but he's also a progressive, and he's also pushing for the right stuff on this. And look, this is one of the biggest hurdles that we deal with in winning these arguments and conversations. As you said, one is just engagement, people knowing what's going on, because they can't just rely on what's told to them by the New York Times and CBS News and these kinds of places, or the Huffington Post and Gawker and those kinds of places. They can't rely on that if they really want to know what's going on. But on top of that, also, there's just such a slant. I mean, it would be, you know, John, it would be so much easier for me from a career perspective to be a blathering liberal Democrat who's running around screaming about climate change and pointing at everybody, laughing, saying, ha ha, you're racist. I mean, there would be financial and professional benefits for me. I'd have many more places to go, but that's not who I am. But there's a reason why there aren't that many people who go into conservative media. There's a reason why there aren't that many people who would take these positions, because it's hard to make a living at it. You have far fewer options, and the deck is stacked against you. I'm not trying to be whiny about it, but I'm just telling you, man. And that's why even sportscasters and these other people take the positions they do, because it's just essentially burnishing their brand, you know? Oh, if you go with sort of the dominant progressive ideology, this is just icing on the cake for you on top of the, you know, NCAA brackets. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. It's infuriating. And, you know, for somebody that I love paying attention to what's going on, I love being involved in the conversation. But for when you want to get away, you feel like you have nowhere to go without, you know,
yeah, I know. It's in your face. The ignorance. That's the thing. People say sports. And John, great call, man. And thank you very much for calling in. And thank you for supporting the show and for being a part of the Hut. I like to think I'm all for sports as an escape, and the stories and the competition and the overcoming. Look, sports are great. I love sports. I've played sports of different kinds my whole life. I've played organized sports. I've played competitive sports. I really enjoy watching professional athletes, but I have to say I view it very much as a diversion. You know, I view watching a football game the way other people would view, you know, watching the Lord of the Rings trilogy or maybe Babylon 5 or I don't know, some other show. Fringe. Somebody told me recently that Fringe is really good. Maybe I'll check that out. I don't know why I'm on sort of a sci-fi fantasy kick with all those shows, but you know what I mean. But I view it in sort of the same context. I don't care about the personal lives of these athletes and all these other things. It's entertainment for me. But what bothers me is you've got like Bob Costas, for example, who's a sportscaster who wants to pretend to be a political pundit who knows about guns. You know, he's going to lecture us on guns. It's just annoying. It's annoying that these people have platform. And then don't even get me started on actors. You know, oh gosh, I should do a whole show on all the actors that I despise because they take these wildly ignorant political positions. But that would have to be a series, not just a show. I'll take more calls. If you're on hold right now, stay with me. Team Buck, back in just a minute.
Buck Sexton.
Taking intelligence to a whole new level.
The Blaze Radio Network.
Buck Sexton Show. Speak your mind. 888-900-3393.
All right, Team Buck, we got a call from Slavic in Illinois. Slavic, you're on the Buck Sexton Show.
Hey, Buck. I called you before. I was kind of sick, so I don't remember.
Sure. Thank you for calling again.
Yeah, thanks. Hey, thanks, Buck. Hey, I just wanted to mention a couple things regarding the Middle Eastern Alliance. Have you heard of Waleed Shabbat? He was a former PLO terrorist.
I've heard of him, yeah.
You've heard him, okay. I don't know if you had him on the show on Glenn Beck, or maybe you should get him on, but he knows a lot of the stuff that's going on right now, and his predictions, he runs a website called shoebad.com, and I follow it all the time. He says that the real players in here is Turkey, because he says that, you know, the whole, like, tongue-lashing against Iran is really just a cover for Turkey to unite with Iran against Saudi Arabia, and that they want, you know, to destroy Saudi Arabia, and I was wondering what your thoughts were on that.
That Turkey wants to destroy, or who wants to destroy Saudi Arabia?
Well, Turkey wants to ally with Iran because Iran has 35 million people who come from the Turkish ethnic groups. And so eventually they're going to ally with Iran to take down Saudi Arabia because they don't like the Wahhabi Muslims.
I find that a very tough sell with Turkey. Yeah. And thank you for calling in, Slavic. I find that a very tough sell with Turkey being a Sunni Muslim country. Of course, it's Turks, not Arabs, but a Sunni Muslim country nonetheless. So I would find it very difficult to imagine that they would ally with Iran against Saudi Arabia for the destruction of Saudi Arabia. But I'll give it some more thought, perhaps. One quick note. There was that incident at the NSA, where an SUV rammed a car and tried to jump the barriers, and there are some sources that say that there were drugs and a firearm found in that car. One individual was killed, another was wounded in that shooting. They were apparently dressed as two men were dressed as women, and they tried to run the barrier, run the gate. And they were unsuccessful. Fortunately, very hard to get into these places. And there is also much better security now than there used to be. For those of you who may not know, there was years ago on January 25th, 1993, there was an incident at the CIA's front gate with a man named Emal Kazi. And he walked up to cars that were about to turn into Langley. So clearly people on their way to the CIA, almost certainly because they work there, with an AK-47, and he fired into cars waiting to make the left turn. There were a number of CIA employees killed and more wounded, and he managed to get away, which is just astonishing when you think about it. He actually managed to get on a plane back to Pakistan. He went to his apartment, he packed, and he managed to get to Pakistan, and they bought protection from an Afghan warlord for him and smuggled him across the border into Afghanistan. So he really, talking about going on the lam, I mean, he's under the protection of an Afghan warlord. The FBI managed to put him on the most wanted list and track him down with, they had a $2 million reward, which they raised to $3.5 million. But it took until 1997 A combined FBI and CIA team lured Kazi to a meeting in Pakistan, and they were able to grab him there. They did a snatch and grab there, and they brought him back to this country. And then on November 14th, 2002, he was executed via lethal injection at a Virginia state penitentiary. So these sorts of incidents have happened in the past. This one was minor, at least from the perspective of those at the NSA. One individual was killed in this. A bizarre situation that's not believed to be terrorism. But one thing I can tell you is that as much as I talk to you about the lethargy and sloth within bureaucracies in the intel community, you go after the actual agency itself, they will move heaven and earth to get justice and retribution. They will do whatever needs to be done. So anyway, nothing more from that front gate issue with the NSA, except for one dead and one wounded who's going to be facing trial. All right, T-Buck, tomorrow I'll be with you at noon, of course, in the hut. Looking forward to that. And I'll be joining you tonight at 7 Eastern on the Blaze TV. If you haven't checked that out, please do. Thank you for joining me. Shields high.
The Buck Sexton Show on the Blaze Radio Network.